Everybody, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I want to welcome you to today's webinar on Best Fit, How to Choose the Right Applicant. Times may be tough when it comes to finding job applicants, but once the application comes in the door, identifying the right applicant is incredibly important. Knowing the right questions to ask and building a screening process that maximizes the likelihood of finding candidates who are going to be the best fit is as important as ever. Today in this webinar, which is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning, we have a panel of experts from across the industry and the broader HR industry here to discuss ways to help companies develop hiring best practices. Before introducing the panel, I wanted to take a quick second to talk about the AccountsRecovery.net Slack channel. I did just drop a link in the chat window for you if you haven't clicked on it yet. Encourage you to click on it now. It's completely free, doesn't cost you anything. And join the channel. By joining the channel, you'll join 650 other members of the ARM industry who are using the Slack channel to stay in touch with one another, to network with one another, and just sort of keep on top of what's going on in the industry. So I fully encourage anybody who's got that link to click on it now and join. Now let me introduce you to today's panelists. Mike DiCarpio has 28 years of management experience working for some of the best agencies in the industry, such as Amcol Systems, BCA Financial, and RevSolve, USCB, and now has his own consulting company, Prompt Pay Consultant. Richard Falk has worked in the collection industry for 30 years and is a training and hiring expert. He's done extensive research on collector and collection management profiles since the 1980s. He has worked as director of training and assessment for two large national collection agencies and consulted for major bank card, third-party bank card, commercial, medical, and legal collection firms. He has also been an owner of a bank card and legal collection company. He is the president and CEO of People Decisions, which is an online testing firm that is widely utilized by collection firms and call centers. His collector surveys are utilized throughout North America, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. Jessica Haig is a senior manager of consulting at Wunderlich, where she leads a team of analysts, consultants, and learning and development professionals focused on internal organizational development and client consulting projects. Specifically, she specializes in designing and implementing organizational development initiatives, conducting job analysis and validation studies, and educating clients on hiring best practices using Wunderlich's pre-employment assessment solutions. Xavier Nelson joined the Greenberg, Grant, and Richards family more than 10 years ago in the ARM and collections industry. During this time, Xavier has been part of the operations as well as HR and training, and has focused his career on talent acquisition and development. Xavier and his family live in the National Forest, and he's an avid traveler and fan of beaches. Our format for today is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them during the course of our conversation today. To submit a question, you can drop it into the chat window, or you can click on the Q&A tab in your Zoom webinar control panel and send it to us that way. All right, let's start by asking what I think is an important question, at least. And how important is it to hire the right person for the job? Meaning not just, yes, it's important, but, you know, is it possible to quantify how much it can cost a company if the wrong person is hired? And Xavier, we'll let you kick our discussion off today.
Appreciate it, and thank you for having me, Mike. Small correction, I just recently joined Greenberg, Grant, Richards. I've been in the ARM industry for over 10 years. Somebody that's on our panel is to blame for it all, and that is Dr. Falk. And thank you very much for introducing me into our world, Rick. You know, I've enjoyed our time always working together and growing with your mentorship, so I do appreciate that. As far as the importance of bringing the right person on board, I can't stress it enough. You know, there are a lot of different studies and a lot of different companies. Every company kind of has to figure out what their cost per hire is, but not just their cost per hire, but also that cost per loss, essentially. You know, a lot of times companies look at it as 1.5 times the annual salary to replace somebody. But when you add in things such as assessments and testing and drug screening and background screening, it can add up quickly. And then you add in, of course, in licensing fees that might be coming in, as well as getting somebody registered in certain states to be able to collect there. The costs just keep rising and growing. So it is incredibly important to hire the right person out of the gate. And besides that, we want people to be successful in our industry. We want people to grow in this industry. We don't want this industry to be some, you know, like a lot of other call centers where the turnover is every 1 to 2 years. We're very fortunate here at Greenberg, Grant & Richards that our average tenure is 9.5 years. And that's very high.
Yeah, I'll jump in really quick too and say, like, it really is unique to the organization. Obviously, there's some benchmarks out there, and they vary in what they include in the cost of the hire. But, like, I think one thing people can do as part of the recruiting process is count, take account of their own cost per hire in their organization by adding up your internal costs. So, like, salary, training, onboarding, opportunities lost, and then external costs. So, job posting, attraction, all of the external, you know, how do I attract the right people to this organization, and divide that by the number of hires you make. And so you can keep tabs on the cost per hire specific to your organization, because what you do see is a lot of variation in the statistics out there, anywhere from 30% to 60% of the first year salary are things I've seen on things such as like Forbes and Harvard Business Review and the SHRM, so Society for Human Resource Management. They all vary, and it depends on what they're including specifically, but it's a lot.
And just to add to that, and I think you just touched on it as well, you have lost revenue. You also have lost client satisfaction. So you have the potential for compromised service delivery, as well as the indirect cost of investment from your staff who's developing the skills of people as well. I always look at hiring as buying a used car. Do you want to accept the sales pitch of someone that, you know, you might end up with a lemon, or do you want to get the Carfax where you actually do the background and you discover what you're actually getting yourself into?
As far as if people want to say a general number, it's one thing, but basically in about 20 different agencies that I've worked with, when they have quantified it down based on different varieties of measures, and whether they want to count the trainer or the manager in the process and taking out their time and the time they could have given to someone else, the smallest fraction of number per hire, bad hire, is $10,000 to $22,000. And if you've got horrendous turnover, like back in the 81, when I started, the average tenure in the collection industry was only 375%. So my job when I was first hired as a consultant and then as an onboard guy for GC Services back in the day, I was told to clone the very best collectors and also basically profile the weakest ones and then be able to hire the best. And we went from 325%, which was lower than the national average. Within 1 year, we went down to 32%. And the only reason it was that high is because everybody knew that we created a very good training program for the time. And we'd already screened them, so they were getting direct calls from competitors. So it can be shrunk, and we've had it as low as 17% at different places. But it really is something that we should all look for. National average right now is probably about 150%, and it probably will go up for various factors.
Xavier, I see you nodding your head up and down agreeing that you think the turnover rate is going to go up in the industry.
I think there's definitely going to be some changes. As companies are coming back to the office, we're finding that some staff are preferring to stay at home, and some companies cannot accommodate that. And so, unfortunately, there has to be a separation at that point. And, you know, obviously, we have to then backfill those seats. It's an unfortunate situation, but it is just a sign of the times. You know, there's a changing landscape, and there is going to be some shuffling, some shifting back and forth, trying to find that medium ground that's going to work for everybody involved. And as we go through that, kind of like last year, you know, when everybody was trying to figure out how do we make the remote world work. And, you know, some companies were better prepared for that and ready to rock and roll, whereas other companies kind of need a little bit of extra time to get that into place. Now, as everybody starts to come back to the office again, we have to, of course, address some of those concerns as well, because, you know, our staff are concerned, our companies are concerned, and everybody wants everybody to be safe and healthy.
What's interesting is not everyone can work from home. and be effective. To profile a person that is effective in the office versus someone that can actually work at home, key factors would be resourcefulness, goal orientation, self-discipline, and ability to plan, you know, for contingencies, deals with kids and whatnot. But they almost have to be a workaholic, so they're very much on task and are willing to make up anything that occurs during the day. So you've just narrowed the population down: resourcefulness, self-discipline, loyalty, good work ethic, you know, those, and good time management skills. How many can say 10%, 15%, what is it? It's actually about 25% of the population can actually fit into that and sustain that productivity.
I think to add to that too, it's part on the organization and the right tools that you equip people with as well, and placing some trust in like your applicants. Obviously there's like data and security risk issues where not everybody can be working from home, but like if the equipment's there, and there's support and resources from the organization, I think it makes it a little easier. And also like a focus on the outcomes more so than hours. I think that's a big paradigm shift for a lot of organizations as we look at the return to work, where people are looking more so at like, do I need to have somebody in a seat 40 hours a week? Or do I need to make sure that they're hitting certain indicators that performance and work is getting done? I think that there's a lot of people, I think as Xavier said, like not everyone was prepared to go to remote work, but not a lot of organizations are prepared to shift the way that they monitor and hold people accountable for the work being done. And you know, historically, that's been hours and seats in an office. And so I think there's a paradigm shift that has to occur as well as we address the return to work situation with hybrid and remote and ongoing. And I agree with you. I think there's a lot to say that like people who are highly dependable, highly autonomous in their ability to get their work done and don't require a lot of heavy overload and supervision are more likely to be successful. But I think a lot of it too is a shift in the way that organizations measure performance, and a focus on outcomes rather than hours in the future will also enable more people to be successful in their role.
True, but when we go back in time, it was all about the performance. But clients actually have their own requirements. You know, certain amount of each account has to be called certain amount of times. They get enough, you know, letters and follow up, etc. So it makes it difficult, you know, whether they're in the seat for the full 40 hours or whether they can break it up with other part-time people so that the actual accounts meet client requirements.
I want to break in for a second here. We have a question as we're talking about remote work. There was a question that came in, so I'll use it as an opportunity to ask it and to remind everybody who's watching. If you have a question for our panel, send it to us through the chat or the Q&A tab, and we'll get it asked and answered during our conversation today. And the question is, are there keywords or answers to look for when screening a remote employee to know if they will be successful? Now, how do you identify all of the skills that you listed, Rick? How do you sort of start to develop a process to identify that if you're hiring somebody remotely?
Well, it's easy for me because I have a testing site. it's called peopledecisions.com, but it does measure those things. And it becomes very statistically significant over time. Now, Jessica also talks about, she's going to talk about Wonderlic. And all the research that I have done, and it's been only a sample of 10,000, what we found is that you can say there's a cutoff score here, and you've got probabilities of success. So just using the Wonderlic and nothing else, for example, if a person scores a 20, you've got a 50% chance of success. I'm not going to tell you the bottom number, like whether it's two or three numbers below 20, where you only have a 15% chance of success. But going the other way, if you have a 30 on it, you know, if you're not fast tracking that individual, there's just about an 85% turnover rate. So you've got some various deals, and 26 is usually when you get a good manager. So 26 to about 28 is the norm for the national averages, just on quality of a candidate for different positions. Now, the kinds of questions that you're going to ask is, well, I've got a whole interview guide that also is helpful. But you kind of go through, and there's ways of doing things that it depends on if you have huge amounts of people that you're screening. For example, when I was, well, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to give all the war stories. But if I was going to have about 1,000 people that I needed to hire in about a 4-month period, and we did massive marketing, I would actually do a telephone screen, an initial one first. And I actually do it in two ways. First, I would have a leave message deal where they'd say, I'd say, thank you so much for calling in. In this case, Xavier, GGR. We're so glad you've responded. And we're going to get back to you as soon as we can. But first, we'd like to give you the opportunity to give your name, your telephone number, the best time to reach you, why you think this would be a good job for you, and why should we hire you? And so on a voicemail type thing, you can actually go through in person. Hey, my name is Jose Mendez, whatever. And you go, delete. And you're on to the next one. So then you've got this pool of people that go into the next box, and you can actually call them. You do a short term. What your tendency is to actually exclude people, more so than include them. So you're going to ask, how do they sound? Are they professional? Do they have assertion? What are their goals? You can even do some online screen right off the bat. You can say, you can have a website, go to this website. Do you have reliable transportation to get to this address? About how far are you from it? And what we find is that there's turnover, significant turnover. But if they're within 5 miles, they could be a very steady workforce. So that's one indicator. You can ask silly behavioral questions like, what were the competitive sports that you played in high school? Did you ever play in collegiate ball? And what we find is that even the type of sport that they were involved is indicative of success. We all know that collections is a competitive sport, and it's fun for some. And you've got to have a thick skin to be able to handle this industry with all the stuff that gets thrown at you. Now, I could drill down and give you specific questions, but that kind of gives you a little flavor of how to screen, because if you put a lot of time up front with people, they're not going to, you're going to be wasting a lot of time. And then once you kind of screen out folks down the road, then you can drill down and ask, you know, really good questions.
If I may, go ahead, Jessica.
Oh, I was just going to weigh in as like another assessment provider. So Rick mentioned our Wonderlic assessment, which has been around for 80 years. It really focuses on somebody's ability to learn and to solve problems. And so there's a ton of research out there that shows that cognitive ability or general mental ability is like the single best predictor of job performance moving forward when he talks about those probabilities that he was mentioning. Our latest solution, given the changes to the workforce, also looks at do people want to do the type of work, as you're saying, like do they have certain interests that align with the type of tasks that they'll be doing. And also, to his point, like those stable personality traits. If you need a ton of stress tolerance because you have, you know, irritable or hostile conversations, you need to be able to overcome objections, you know, handle and persist despite obstacles. Those types of things are very stable traits that certain people possess that are linked to job performance too. So I think, as he was mentioning, as you look at like a very wide funnel up front with a lot of variability in performance and indicators of like the type of experience that they've had and the type of traits that they're bringing with them, one of the ways to funnel and narrow the funnel like consistently is like a screening tool that can help you focus on those with more potential long-term and weed out those who are less likely to fit like the stable traits and characteristics of the job. So I just wanted to kind of follow what he was saying and say like there is some, you know, tools there to help consistently and more fairly narrow down the funnel, focus on those job-related skills, traits, abilities that help predict and increase your odds of making a good hire down the line. Obviously, without any tools, you probably have about as much likelihood as flipping a coin on who's going to be a good fit. So,
well, and I've used Wunderlic. I've used People Decisions actually for years. I also have used the Predictive Index, and I'm actually a certified talent optimization leader. And I love my tools, all of them. And quite frankly, but one of the things that Rick brought up, and it's something that I use all the time, and that is getting the candidate to put some skin in the game. And I'm not talking about the sports question per se, but you know, when I reach out to a candidate, I'm going to have a conversation with them because ultimately we are in collections and we are in the accounts receivable management industry and we're going to be on the phone. So I want to know how they sound on the phone. I want to know how they interact on the phone. So my biggest thing right out of the gate is definitely a phone screen becomes involved. But I start out with utilizing assessments, using knockout questions to kind of give me an idea of, you know, why do you believe that you are a great candidate for this position? Simple questions that are open-ended. I want them to have to say more than just yes or no. And ultimately, I want to see how they communicate with me. And then that way, I can tell if they have some extra skin in the game. I use a couple other steps that also allow me, for example, if I send out an assessment, you know, early on in the process, if a candidate responds to that and completes it, or they have a question about it, but they actually are communicating with me and opening that dialogue, now I know that candidate has more skin in the game.
You guys have covered pretty thoroughly the way that we question a candidate. One of the things that I've always found important to me is the questions that they ask of us. Pay attention and engage, like you just said, Xavier, have them engage with you. And the questions that they ask, did they research the position? Did they research the company? Have they taken the time to get to know what they're potentially going to do or the people that they're going to work with? Because if they haven't, then they're not vested in doing a good job or doing the job for you or you as a company.
One of the funny things that you can do as a screening tool, believe it or not, and I started this back in the 80s as well, as I would actually create a written document that had questions in it, and they would actually read through it. And it would be when they came in just before giving the application to fill out, I had this document that says, so you want to be a collector? And then I went into all the woes of being a collector, the abuse you get. And I went on for 3 pages, and I had people having to answer questions about that. And I had, on average, about 50% of the folks just leave at that point. They go, oh my gosh, this sounds horrible. And so I didn't have to deal with them, didn't even have to deal with real paperwork as far as applications go. So they self-selected out. So you can do kind of clever things. Another thing that on the web page that you have, if you diverted them to that, is to ask, what are their salary expectations and why? If they say that their salary expectations are $145,000, and this is the first job in collections that they're going to have, you're going to go, next.
Well, and there's a, to follow up on that, Rick, is a simple question of, How many calls on average do you handle per day? You know, this is, as Rick said, it is a sport. You know, some might even say it's a contact sport. But ultimately, our goal is, and the simple formula to success is, the more calls you make, the more people you talk to and help, ultimately, the more successful you're going to be, and you're going to make more money, ideally. So I want to know, how ready are they to pound the phone, just to put it simply. I want to know that they have the energy, that drive, that determination to succeed, that long-term goal-setting mind that is going to go after quota, knock it out of the park. I want to know. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm going to exclude somebody who maybe has not had experience on the phone, but it is going to be one of the factors that I'm going to look at is how are they operating on the phone, how quickly are they operating on the phone, and what are they used to knocking out of the park?
Excellent. I'm just going to jump in for 1 second. I want to hit the pause button briefly on our conversation because I want to invite Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning, the sponsor of today's webinar, to say a few words. Chris.
Thank you, Mike. Hello, everyone. We appreciate the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. I want to say before I continue my introduction is that I use Jessica's tools at Wunderlich in my prior career in executive position collection agency, Rick's tools, and I worked with Mike, and they were all absolutely critical to cutting the bottom out of turnover, increasing revenue. These tools worked without a doubt. So just my opinion. Our company provides a knowledge source. It's the leading workforce education, compliance, and micro learning training platform to companies with collection operations. Knowledge source is used by our clients to simplify training and to lower the cost, simplify and lower the cost of training new and in existing employees, both on-site and remote. Our clients are companies that want to build a high assurance level that their staff members have learned and are maintaining their mastery of the knowledge necessary when they interact with consumers. Knowledge Source automatically builds documentation of your training efforts for clients, prospective clients, and for regulators. For those of you I don't know or haven't met, as mentioned earlier, I spent much of my career in executive positions in collection firms. Knowledge Source was designed to address the challenges and opportunities in training staff members. Use Knowledge Source to implement an ongoing training cycle where you are reinforcing the knowledge that you expect your staff members to have. Present collection, compliance, client policies, company policies to your staff members during onboarding and afterward at recurring schedules to gain acknowledgement that they have read and understand those policies for a record of it and for documentation for your compliance management system. Present tests during training events and afterward to validate learning and to create documentation that your staff members know these areas such as the FDCPA. Present videos, slideshows, audio recordings during onboarding training courses and lessons. And afterwards, when someone has been released to their job function, in order to dramatically lower the amount of time before they become proficient, and afterwards to keep focus on best practices. In summary, Knowledge Source will close knowledge gaps, lower the cost of training, promote accountability, and document for clients, prospective clients, for regulators, for auditors, your company's proactive role in preventing errors, preventing compliance nonconformities, and in maximizing revenue. For more information, go see us at peakrevenuelearning.com. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. And thanks again to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. I did put a link in the chat to the company's website, so just click on that and you can check them out today. There was an interesting question that came in that frames a couple of other just questions that have come in related to the labor market today. And the question that we have that came in is, right now the job market's very tight and we don't have much time to keep a candidate engaged. We also don't have the luxury of being as selective. What are some strategies to choose maybe a candidate who you normally wouldn't consider, but now need to consider due to the high demand and the current job market?
I'll start that one. Don't compromise your hiring criteria, because you're going to compromise. You're hiring into your turnover rate, very simply, and you're also putting people who are less qualified for the position in front of your best accounts. You don't want to do that. Stay true to your hiring practices and don't compromise.
I would like to add on, and Mike is 100% right. You know, it's not just about filling a seat. You know, that, you know, there might be some customer service programs or some, maybe sometimes a first party program that is more about filling a seat than about production. But ultimately, it's about compliance as well. It is about the company. It is about the culture of your company and your existing staff. We want people to grow and succeed with us. I don't want to see people going in and out of the door. I want to see people advancing themselves to a higher portfolio, or like in my case, going that corporate route and then moving their way up the ranks there. We want to see them succeed. I don't want to set anybody up for failure. And so I can only agree, don't compromise.
I'd like to jump in too. One of the things that you could start doing is looking at, and you actually have, it's wise to track all your recruiting efforts, all your ads, and see which ones are successful, which ones aren't. It helps tremendously to actually create contests within your own office using your existing employees and give bonuses for them bringing in people who are hireable. So if you've got your entire staff actually getting rewards, and like if you get five people in, you get three cherries on top of a sundae. Whatever kind of contest you can have, make it meaningful, and don't, you know, have it so far out that they don't get motivated. For example, if they're hired on the job for a month, they get X. If they're on for 2 months, they get another X plus two. If they're on for 3 months, you're creating tenure. And you can actually do the recognition stuff. You can have a plaque with each month, how many people did they, recruit for you? This can be a fun thing. And, you know, once a month, you know, after closeout, the following day, you go, for people that have actually contributed to expanding your staff. But I guarantee, and I've been doing it more than 30 years, if you want to count up the time, it's actually been 40 years. It's been since 1981. I've been working in the industry. I had over 30 years, but 40 sounds like I'm an old geezer. I guess I am. But anyway, it's try to other avenues. Go out and try different things. It's interesting that you can try military bases, believe it or not, but not the guys. For college recruiting program, you can get the guys that are leaving and they might be really good. But believe it or not, the wives of the junior officers often are very good. So it's like you just start looking in different places, you run some experiments, and some of them will be more than home runs. But you have to be creative.
I'll jump in too from an attraction perspective. I think you can try varying the job description that you have out there, to Rick's point as well. Like, track the quality you're getting from the different sources you're using. a lot of times people will put all their apples in one basket and, you know, like sponsor a job on Indeed and hope that we get, you know, new, diverse, quality candidates, but you're fishing from the same well. So if you can expand where you're attracting from and also look for those transferable skills, there might be related jobs where they, you know, they've practiced resourcefulness or they've practiced and have demonstrated stress tolerance in the face of that. Like, if you can look at like transferable skills in similar industries, you broaden your net as well. Obviously, like putting food on the table is like table stakes for people. So obviously competitive pay is one thing. But another thing we've found for like attracting people is offering, you know, in advertising that you provide learning and development opportunities. Say, hey, we have a career progression or we have, you know, a plan in place to develop these skills. Like there's non-monetary incentives that sometimes will tip people over the edge if they feel that like what you offer in terms of like base pay is at least enough to put money on the table, then you can attract them through the other things you offer, benefits, like I said, development, other ways to attract people to your role to get some unique and new and diverse talent in there that are also likely to be successful. Because again, you don't want to compromise on your standards, but you can say like, as part of like the job, understanding of the job, like what is necessary at entry and what can we train on and what can we not train on, and set those as kind of like your stakes in the ground of like, we can't train people to have a higher cognitive ability. We can teach them problem solving skills. We can teach them to, you know, compensate for some of like their areas for improvement. So maybe we're not going to compromise on that because it's not developable, but we can teach people how to communicate effectively on the phone. It might be a longer ramp, but there's things like that. That if you put in place, it's a little bit of a longer ramp to start, but once it's in place and flowing, you'll kind of have like a broader reaching pipeline where you don't get into those reactive hiring spots anymore because you've attracted further up in the pipeline. You've started to grow the talent earlier in the pool. And even if they don't stay with your organization more than 3 to 5 years, you've done your job of developing people into better humans for the workforce to benefit the next person. And that they then are brand ambassadors for, I had all these positive experiences with this company, you should apply as your next, you know, job. And so they're going to be their word of mouth long term. So it's a longer process. And it, I agree, don't compromise on standards, but there's creative ways to fish from new pools to bring in that talent.
We've always done things like the management trainee program. And that draws people in, just like Jessica was talking about. Another thing that people don't seem to utilize, but I have found it incredibly helpful. And again, I've been an owner of actually two different collection agencies, and one of them was a law office. But the thing is, so these things are real to me. I'm not just trying to sell a service or come in and say, this is something. But if you go ahead and remember, when you've actually screened people, you can create a qualified bench and you keep their name and phone number and email address, and you've already pre-screened them. Maybe they didn't take the job because another firm actually upped their bonus or whatever it was to keep them at that time, or maybe you had 5 qualified candidates and only one spot to fill, but you had those 4 left over. Keep your finger on those because you can always pull them in later and they're a go-to source. So if you can actually create a whole bench of people that are pre-qualified, then go straight to that right away and you can pull in folks without too much effort rather than starting from scratch. And most HR folks actually start from scratch in this industry, and that's silly in my opinion.
And if I may add to that, Rick is 100% right. I never, ever have 0 candidates in my pool. I always have several hundred candidates to a couple of thousand candidates, depending on the position and the experience level required, in my pool, ready for me to reach out and check in with them, see how they're doing, feel the pulse, see what's new in their life. It's, you know, client relationship management 101. In this case, it's recruiting, you know, relationship management. But I want to stay in touch with them. I want to continue to reach out to them and keep them engaged in a conversation with me. Even if I don't have anything right now that's a good fit for them, sometimes I might be able to ask them, hey, you know, we haven't been able to make something happen, but as you know, I'm still working on that for you. But do you know anybody who might be interested in this other position? And I obviously, a lot of times, I'm going to also then get some good leads out of that candidate for the other position over here. You know, they might be a leadership candidate, for example, and I'm looking for somebody that's more entry level. They may know somebody who's going to be a good fit. So I'm always engaged with my candidate pool, and the conversation never ends.
Good point.
Well, let me reframe the question in a different way that I think everyone would agree. You know, don't compromise on who you're hiring. But, you know, I'm hearing of collection agencies that are, you know, sort of almost, if not hiring on the spot, you know, during the interview or at the end of the interview, in order to keep that person and get an answer and not let that person go because the labor market is so tight, they're hiring on the spot or dramatically sort of accelerating the screening process. If you don't want them to compromise on who they hire, is there a way for them to sort of expedite the hiring process so that, you know, if they do have someone who's qualified to come into their office, they can offer that person maybe in a shorter time frame than they would have in the past.
Well, if I may on that one of the first things that I hear from talking to many different candidates all the time is lack of communication by the companies. And so right out of the gate, candidate applies, and you know, if they have an automated system, an ATS, an applicant tracking system or something like that can help them out, you know, you can have at least a thank you for applying or thank you for expressing an interest in our company and our positions and a career with us. Tell them that you've got the application and their resume and that, you know, you're looking into it. I generally very much like a collector who has, you know, a day and a half to cycle the accounts on their portfolio. I make it a point to try and reach out within less than one business day. Let me rephrase that. But I'll try within less than one business day to reach out to that candidate to at least say, hi, I wanted to touch base personally and thank you for applying and expressing an interest in our careers. Tell me a little bit about your background, and I try to get some extra information. Generally speaking, that turns into a phone screen right out of the gate. I'm having a natural conversation. It's not an interrogation, but a conversation. And I'm asking some general questions. I'm feeling them out and kind of having a chat with them. So right out of the gate, within 2 days, they've had 2 touches from me, whereas tons of companies won't even send them a decline letter.
I agree. There's a non-for-profit organization called Talent Board that actually does a ton of research on the candidate experience. And year over year, the number one complaint is lack of timely communication, whether they're moving forward or they're not. So I think anything you can do to, you know, foster that personal touch and that communication, it helps them engage and understand that, like, it's more than an organization. Now they have a personal connection to a human at that organization. And so they feel more connected. And that helps speed it up. Again, as Xavier mentioned, there's like the applicant tracking systems that can help expedite that. Like saying no to those people who don't have the potential earlier on using screening tools like assessments upfront. You focus your time on those with the most potential, and therefore you can get and talk to more of them than if you're, you know, filtering through 900 resumes of, you know, varying quality. So there's things you can do in processes. I know someone had mentioned knockout questions too. Like if you're able to identify job-related minimum qualifications early on, like if you have a max salary that we can't afford to pay above this, like that could be like if they're out of the salary band and unwilling to compromise, something like that. More specifically, like if they're just missing those potential very stable characteristics, like there's nothing you can train them on or in a expedited way train them on to get them up to speed quickly. Those can be some of the knockout questions. If your organization doesn't sponsor visas, like if you have to be a U.S. citizen to work, that can be a knockout question as well. Most places have to sponsor a visa, but like things like that. Or if you have minimum experience requirements, license, certification requirements, all of those can be like, do you have these or are you attempting to get these type things can be something you do do to like narrow your funnel so you have more time for that more human touch, high value conversation with those that have the most likelihood of being a quality hire.
So if I could, if someone is in front of you and they knock out the interview and it's a great interview and somebody that you would want to hire, why wouldn't you hire them on the spot? I wouldn't understand that. So do it. The market right now is so competitive, and there's good and there's bad reasons for that. You know, in a lot of areas, the unemployments have been extended, which, as Rick talked about earlier, it has already disqualified a great number of people who aren't even looking for a job, who would only normally waste your time in an interview process so they could get your signature and receive their benefits. So you've already eliminated that, but that means that the market has shrunk. The people who are looking for jobs who are qualified candidates that actually do want to work and do a good job for you it has been limited. And so it actually does us good because we've eliminated part of the people that we would normally go through for qualified candidates. But it also makes the competition much more stout. So if you've got someone in front of you that has qualifications and you think is going to do a good job, offer the job. Don't wait.
I agree. Absolutely, Mike. Another thing that if you're having to compromise, let's say a small degree, you're probably going to have to actually hire an extra trainer. This would be for remedial training. Another thing that helps is the needy folks to be closer to the manager's desk so they can have more hands-on. A lot of times new employees will be put down the end of the row, you know, because you got your high performers up close and you want to be moving like that. But what happens is a weaker performer down at the end, or if you don't set them up with a coach next door, next cubicle and help pay them something to actually bring the person along. You're actually shooting yourself in the foot. You gotta, if you don't have all, stars, you've got to work some programs that will bring the level of training up beyond just the few days in the beginning.
Obviously companies are higher, are shooting for 0% turnover, but the reality is that that's definitely not the case. So, to try and keep that number as close to zero as possible, maybe you could talk about some areas where each of you see companies fall short in their process for reviewing candidates. Are there pitfalls that companies can seek to avoid, or ways to sort of look at their process to make sure that they're screening and reviewing applicants that are going to lead to people who are likely to stay?
So if I could start, I'd love to jump on this one. Organizations tend to always hire towards the exception because they found that even though you have expectations and even though you set standards for scoring, because we use Rick's product, we also use Jessica's, but there are always people that qualify under the exception rule that have been successful, can be successful, and they've beaten the odds, so to speak. And so organizations tend to look for exceptions based off of their success rather than sticking to the standards in which they've created. So don't hire to the exception would be my advice.
I think that's a very good point, Mike. Yeah, you're 100% correct. And one thing I'd like to say there too is just as a word of caution for anybody out there, never ever use any screening tool, assessment, or anything, any one step as an absolute knockout. Because ultimately, you might find somebody is maybe weaker on this one assessment, is stronger on these particular questions, has great work experience. Everything should be looked at as a whole, the picture of the whole candidate and their experiences and what they're bringing to the table, not just any one part. So there shouldn't be a yes, no, you're in, you're out, period. No, let me look at the whole. That is always very, very important. But when it comes to the initial piece too, let's look all the way back. Let's backtrack for a minute. The job descriptions, the job postings, how you're getting the word out. there are still tons of job postings out there that talk about, right out of the gate, these are my requirements, these are my qualifications. There's nothing there talking to the candidate of what's in it for them. What's in it for me as a candidate? Why should I even look at your company or consider your company? So let's start there. What do you as a company bring to the table for that candidate? You know, everybody was talking about earlier, you know, learning development. You know, as manager of professional development in a past position, I was very fortunate that I was not just helping develop entry-level collectors, but I was working my way and I was helping everybody all the way through to VPs become better leaders. It's what's in it for the candidate. Let's start there. We can reduce turnover right there.
Yeah, for example, you can reduce turnover by making things age appropriate. If you look at millennials, their needs are a little different from Gen X or old geezers down the road like myself, the boomers. But so what are they looking for? Read the stuff. You're going to find they want something social, whereas other generations are more serious. You know, just leave me alone, get on my way, let me get my job done and make my money. Whereas if you're not providing the right kind of environment, which involves plants and pictures and social gatherings, then you're going to actually be creating turnover because they're going to go to a place where they do get those things.
I want to jump in too. I know you said it's almost impossible to get to zero turnover, but in some regards too, zero turnover is a bad thing if you're not developing your people too, right? Like keeping the wrong people in the role a long time could be as damaging as hiring a new person in who's wrong too. So there is some good turnover when you're able to show people that like they aren't a good fit for the role or the role's no longer a good fit for them. Like there should be like an off ramp as well to say like, hey, you're not producing, you're not being challenged. To your point, you're not learning more. Like if you're not learning, you're not growing and you're not moving yourself or the organization forward. So either like, there has to be a path forward in the organization or a path out of the organization for them. Because I think sometimes those people who are like narrowly getting by or maybe just like flying under the radar and not performing could be just as toxic as bringing in someone new who's toxic as well. So I think there is some degree of turnover that may be a little healthy, as sad as that is. Like, I think it's always best to put people in the right role for them. And sometimes you outgrow a role or the role changes and it no longer fits you. So I think a little bit of turnover is always good if you're not seeing growth out of the people and if they don't feel like they're being challenged. Again, it is a two-way conversation, but like I think a little bit of turnover is good either, you know, from the role itself or from the organization if they no longer align with like a path or a direction to push forward.
One thing that we haven't brought up is profiling the collector to the manager. Believe it or not, that's huge. Because let's say you have a very controlling manager and who tends to micromanage his people. If you get a person who might be a hot dog collector, has 10 years experience, and who's operating, you know, pretty freely and does a great job on his own, you put him in to a micromanaging manager, and he's going to say, I'm out of here. So it's wise to actually really understand the management style of all your managers or supervisors in your company, and then try to funnel folks that actually will do well in that environment, because every manager has its own culture. It's not, and we're stupid if we try to say, let's hire great collectors and it doesn't matter who we shuffle them to, because it does.
Well, on top of that as well, and I've always recommended that not only do you do the profiles when you're hiring people, but you also utilize them along their path and their journey as you develop them. because their personalities and the nuances are going to always come out in those profiles. And you know, the things that are indicative of a performance lag are generally in those profiles. You have to figure out how to connect with that person and motivate them with that information, not just use it as a hiring tool, but use it as a processing tool as they're processing through the entire stage of their career with you.
I would agree on that. You know, one of the things that I did with the predictive index a lot of times is we actually utilize team dynamics reports. So I could kind of find and help build a balanced team that would more effectively be able to move forward, help each other out, you know, kind of fill in the gaps of, you know, okay, I've got three, as Rick called them, the hot dog collectors, right? You know, these three top guns, but I have, you know, nobody that is a more balanced or somebody that could maybe be very effective on a crosstalk on helping basically de-escalate another situation. I want to build a more balanced team. I want them to have all aspects in place. And so profiling, not just the candidate, as far as, you know, looking at what makes a great collector, but also look at, like Rick said, which manager is this collector, this candidate best suited to, but also which team is this candidate best suited to?
Now, Mike brought up a point about collector development as well, and or management development. But they would actually, like, whether it's predictive index or some of the surveys, I do also management profiles, but on a collector that's being brought in, let's say their social skills are a little bit low. Well, you know right away, or maybe they're not as assertive as they could, but they're kind of in the slightly above average, but you want a third party card collector. You'll want them a little bit more assertive. So you work primarily on their talk off, on getting them to memorize it, to actually come up with and understand the typical 10 best rebuttals to the various kinds of questions. So that you work more on that versus other things. You can see other folks that are less competitive and more thin-skinned. Well, you work on deflecting. So you can actually create a career collector who may or may not go up the ladder, but that they can be happy and feel successful. Another thing that is important is to find out what motivates the individual. Is it praise? Is it money? Is it challenge? Is it fear? You know, by understanding what really motivates a person, you can actually keep them kind of in their peak performance zone just by feeding them what they need. It's very helpful.
Couldn't agree more on that, Rick. You know, ultimately in leadership and in leadership development, we need to focus on speaking and working and talking with our associates, whether they're at the candidate level or whether they're already on board with us. You need to keep working and keep talking to your associates and to your team. Find out what makes them tick. There are different things that motivate me in different ways for different reasons at different times. Somebody who knows me, Rick, for example, knows how to push which button at what point in time to get a certain reaction out of me. And that is invaluable because I need to also be able to trust in a leader that they're going to use their power for good, not for evil. It's not all about, you know, let's hammer this down, let's get the most money in there, but somebody who's also looking out for me, who has my best interest in mind. And so it's down to the organization to build a culture that has the best interest of their associates and that growth in mind.
So just to tie in, and this actually ties into the very beginning of this entire webinar, one of the things that we talked about when it comes to the cost of turnover is morale. There's a direct correlation to how well your organization morale is based on its turnover. And you can't put a value on that. There's no way to do that, but it's a very important component, because the higher the turnover, the lower the morale.
Huge.
Well, on that note, unfortunately, we've run out of time, so we'll have to wrap things up. But Jessica, Rick, Xavier, Mike, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and your expertise and sharing that with our audience today on behalf of everybody who's watching and listening and walking away smarter and a little bit better informed. I really appreciate your time and your participation today. Thank you. Thanks again to Chris Rickman at Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Please check them out at peakrevenuelearning.com. When I end the webinar, there'll be a webpage that'll pop up. You can share your feedback on today's event, and also an opportunity to share any ideas, things you want to see covered in an upcoming webinar, something keeping you awake at night, questions you're looking to get answered, a problem you're looking to get solved. Just, you know, include a note there, and I'll be sure to put it on the list for a webinar in the next month or so. So we'd love to see that as well. Thank you, everybody, for participating today. There's a link in the chat. If you haven't signed up for tomorrow's webinar on technology trends impacting collections, I highly recommend you do so. It's a great panel of experts who are going to be talking about technology in the ARM industry. So I highly encourage everybody to sign up for that. And hope to see you back tomorrow. Until then, everyone, have a great rest of your day. Panel, thank you so much. Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you.